Well, welcome. Good morning. I'm Michelle Davis, Executive Director of Nonprofit Connect, and we are excited to welcome you to the first of six learning circles on the Giving USA and Giving in Kansas City reports, which will evolve in 2010 into our fundraising learning circles. So we are pleased to have you here with us today. And I want to also start by thanking the partners on this program, Jeffrey Byrne and Associates and Greater Kansas City Community Foundation. And I think we know that they are definitely dedicated to this community. And I've just been amazed over the past few weeks as we've been working on developing this program and analyzing the results of the survey you took, how committed they are to this program and to really helping give you tools that will help you raise more money. So let's give them a big thanks for all their hard work. Okay, in front of you, you'll have a variety of things that we'll go through as we get started today. The yellow sheet has highlights the upcoming Nonprofit Connect programs and events. And one thing I want to make you especially aware of, there are a few outside on the desk. As you leave, you can grab one. You should have received in the mail the flyer for the 2009 Philanthropy Midwest Conference on November 18th and 19th, and it is packed with incredible, incredible speakers this year. The board was really excited to see the lineup that we've brought in. There are four tracks to choose from: marketing and communications, fundraising, management and governance, and nonprofit trends and issues. We have two incredible keynotes, Paul Light and Robert Egger. So lots of great opportunities. I will mention that there are scholarships available, and that scholarship deadline is Monday. So if you go to our website or go to philanthropymidwest.org, you can gain information about those scholarship opportunities. The other thing I would alert you to is that there is a 10% discount if you register five or more people from your organization. So that's a great opportunity for you to bring additional staff, for you to also bring board members. There's a special track just for board members this year. So I encourage you to check this out. If you have any questions, stop Amy, who's out at the desk, or myself, and we'll be glad to answer those questions for you. A little bit about today's program and kind of the impetus for this is that for the past several years, Nonprofit Connect has been doing convening learning circles, and they are a little bit different than our educational seminars. Instead of coming for just a presentation, we really want the focus of the learning circles to be a dialogue and a sharing of resources and a way for you to meet new people that you might begin to share resources with or network with or collaborate with. And we've been doing this for several years now, and This year we did a few that were had a fundraising focus, but in 2010 we're going to be launching a fundraising learning circle that will meet four times throughout the year. They will meet for a period of 2 hours when they meet. The first hour will be focused on some fundraising topic. The discussion will focus on that, and in the second hour you will break back out into the sector groups, just like we're doing today, so that the people that you're meeting with again today, you'll have an opportunity to continue to meet with them throughout 2010. And our goal is really that today you will begin to, as you listen to the dialogue, identify people that maybe have things in common with you, or organizations that have things in common with you that you want to network with, or maybe someone that gives an idea that makes you say, I want to continue to talk with them and learn more about what they're doing. So that's really the focus of what we're hoping that you'll get out of today. We also hope that you may take a look around the room and identify people that didn't make it today's session that work in healthcare fundraising that you want to invite to continue the dialogues in 2010. The last two things I want to remind you about today's session are, number one, is that we are audio recording it. So as we, of course, the speakers will all have microphones. As we ask questions, we will come to you with a microphone so that it can be recorded, and then that'll be available on our website. So if there's something, if you want to come back and listen to something from today's session, you have the opportunity to download the handouts and then download the audio recording that you can listen to at any time or share with a colleague that maybe wasn't here today. And then the other thing I want to let you know is that to continue the learning, we're also going to be doing a special winter edition of the eLink magazine, and that will also include a summary of the results for each of the different sectors, as well as kind of a summary of some of the key ideas that came out of today's session. So our goal is really that the learning just doesn't stop today. Giving USA was launched in July with the initial results. Today we're breaking it down by the healthcare sector, and we'll continue to have that dialogue through podcasts, through eLink, and then through the continued learning circles in 2010. can. So we're excited to provide you all those opportunities, and we hope that it makes a big impact for each of you. So with that, I will turn it over to Jennifer Farla.
Thank you, Michelle, and good morning. You know, about 5 years ago, we had the pleasure of first partnering with the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation to bring Giving USA to Kansas City. And the question was always, okay, well, that's Giving USA. So what about Kansas City? So on July 9 of this year, we brought to you Giving in Kansas City. And I know many of you were here and heard that broad overview. And these sector sessions are designed to drill down a bit further to say, okay, what about healthcare in Kansas City? So my job this morning is to talk to you about some of those broader statistics again and bring it back and drill it down into the healthcare sector. It might be a review for some of you, but it's really worth emphasizing. One thing that you should know that I think is exciting is that this dialogue not only continues with you in the healthcare sector, but also with the Funders Forum, which will be, Michelle, September 22nd. And while we will have only had this one sector session under our belt at that time, the intention is that we'll continue to feed the information back and forth among you who are working out in the nonprofit community, doing the fundraising, working in the trenches, as well as those who are making some of the decisions regarding funding priorities, at least from the foundation side. Okay, so let's look at what that big picture is. And just to put it back in perspective for you, this is Giving USA for 2009, covered the numbers of 2008 nationally, $307 billion given in the United States. If you remember, if you're good with numbers and remember what that report was last year, we said that giving in 2008 was down 2% in current dollars, 6% adjusted for inflation from 2008 over 2007. The reason for that is that the Giving USA numbers always, when they come out in July, are estimates. By the time we got through the end of 2008, the estimate was revised upward, 2007, and giving in 2007 in the United States was actually $314 billion, the highest ever. Now compare that with 2006. It was about $304 billion, $305 billion. So really, as I interpret those numbers, what we're talking about is rather flat experience from 2006 to 2008. Yet what you heard in the media was a spike in 2007 and then a fairly substantial decrease from giving in 2007 to giving in 2008. You'll look at the pieces of the pie, individuals representing about 75%, when you add bequests about 82%, and when you add family foundations about 88% of the pie. So we'll look in a few minutes how that compares to Kansas City. Looking briefly at the recipients and who received those dollars, we're really talking about a fairly steady allocation of dollars year over year in the pieces of the pie. In other words, we're talking about roughly a third of the money going to religion fairly consistently. And actually, for the first time in 2008, we had some new sectors coming in, 1% going to grants to individuals that you can see up there at the top. If you look a few years back, animals, environment, international giving, and even gifts to foundations were among the new sectors that were emerging. Just while I fully recognize this is a program on healthcare, I do want you to note that many of you are from faith-based organizations working in the healthcare field. And giving to religion did spike this year for the first time from 33% to 35%. So that is something of note in terms of the share of the pie. Now, when you look at that green slice there for healthcare, you can see that giving to healthcare nationally represents about 7% of total giving. Okay, let's look at the giving by sources. According to Giving USA, giving was only up in one area, and that was giving by foundations. That was 2007, 2008 over the prior year, 2006, 2007. You'll note there that there's a fairly good difference there in bequests, and I do want to remind you, if you recall back to the July program, that bequest giving is something that's really just a snapshot. So if you're looking at these numbers and trying to interpret these for your constituents, for donors, for volunteers, that does not necessarily allow us to draw conclusions about efficacy of planned giving programs. It's really a function of who died during the year who had charitable intent. And the Center on Philanthropy will tell us that those numbers in terms of bequest giving are really driven by about 300 estates nationally. So that's something that I think is an interesting number to look at. Let's move on through these. And looking at the changes in giving by recipient organization, giving to the various sectors was down in all but three sectors: giving to religion, giving to public society benefit, and giving to international. You can see there right in the middle, giving to health nationally was down 6.5% from a high of up 5.5% the previous years. That's in current dollars. The difference is even more pronounced when it's adjusted for inflation. Giving to healthcare in 08 was down 10%. Now, I'm not the bearer of all bad news, so we'll move on here to some additional information that could be helpful to you in your fundraising. Even so, we do know that giving year after year in the 40 or 50 years that Giving USA has put out the numbers has generally consistently trended upward. The typical trend is during recessionary years, giving's down 1.9 to about 2.7%. And you can see, those are represented by the green bars, you can see the blue bars there, that giving is usually up during non-recessionary years by about 4%. I think another statistic that you might want to take note of when you're communicating the importance of charitable giving and, frankly, some optimism for giving with your donors is the percentage that giving represents of the GDP. This is a rather new slide for Giving USA, and it shows you that giving has pretty consistently represented about 2%, 1.5% to 2% of the GDP. Now, this does give us some questions about how we raise the bar, how we move giving upward, but it also tells us that that giving is very much a function of the economy, and that really when you look at 2008 compared to 10 or even 20 years prior, we were actually making some progress in relation to the overall economy. So let's look at giving in Kansas City. The big number is $2.15 billion. If you had a chance to read the report, you'll know that that represented 0.7% of giving nationally. That number matches the same percentage that Kansas City as a metropolitan area represents to the U.S. population. So no surprise there. How we look at where we start to see the changes are when you look back at those numbers with sources and with the uses or the recipients. And where we see some significant differences are giving to foundations representing only 70%, giving from households representing only 70% of giving to in Kansas City versus foundations and corporations representing almost 25% of giving in Kansas City. What does that suggest? A much more healthy institutional community in terms of the institutional giving, but to me it suggests quite a bit of opportunity with respect to giving from households and giving from individuals. You might take a note of some numbers here. What is that 70%? If you can do the math, what does that 70% translate to? $1.6 billion is what that market share represents for you of giving to all nonprofits. Giving from foundations, about $400 million. And giving from corporations, about $150 million. When we look at how those dollars are distributed, you can see some differences here, and particularly in the healthcare sector, giving to healthcare causes represented about 5% of charitable giving in Kansas City versus its benchmark of 8% nationally. You can see here that that's a contrast to giving to other sectors, giving to human services, to religion, and to public benefit. In real dollars, that represents $107 million, $108 million given to healthcare causes in Kansas City. So there is some reason to be optimistic, even though we are clearly challenged here in terms of the numbers giving to healthcare and it being outpaced by national averages. We have some work to do. But if you look here at average gifts to charity, there's some reason to get out there and to start telling some stories. You can see here that the average gift from Kansas City donors was about $3,300, and that average giving, including non-donors, still outpaced the national average by about 50%. When you look at the differences in income, it becomes even more marked. You can see here that while average household giving is about the same as the national average, Kansas City to the United States, for the lower income households, those $50,000 and under, those in the middle range, $50,000 to $100,000 per year, look at the giving from the income range of $100,000 and more, $7,600 versus $4,200 nationally. That clearly suggests some very generous donors at the higher income markets. And what is, at least for some of us in healthcare, when you look at the preferences of household giving, they tend toward to track the pie chart, the giving pie chart, and tend toward education, toward healthcare, and toward the arts. So to me, that's where we should be focusing our attention. When you look at foundation giving and grants, I think there's another lesson here that we need to pay attention to. And look at healthcare falling right in the middle. You can see here that the average grant is about $26,000. And yet the median grant, meaning the midpoint grant, meaning 50% are higher than and 50% are lower than, was only $2,000. What does that say about where our resources should be put in terms of return of investment for grants? The other thing that you should be aware of, I think it's on page 57 of the Giving in Kansas City report, it lists the largest foundation gifts. And the Prime Health Foundation, or a gift to the Prime Health Foundation, came in at number 7 as one of the largest gifts. It was about $5.8 million during the year that was measured here. So that certainly impacted those averages in terms of foundation giving to health. Another statistic that you should be aware of is that the amount that was given to health in the foundation community represented about 10% of all foundation dollars. That's less than half of what foundations give to health nationally at 24%. So again, we have a little bit of work to do. When you look at corporate giving, the picture is slightly different, and it tends to vary according to the size of the nonprofit seeking the support. You can see here that corporate gifts range from a high of almost $1 million for large organizations all the way down to $1,300 for small organizations. These are not corporate foundation gifts, but are outright corporate gifts. And to me, it suggests a preference when you're talking about how you're requesting the dollars, that it's really about more bang for the buck. It relates to cause marketing. And so when we're talking about the small healthcare organization that's looking to seek corporate dollars versus the juvenile diabetes, the Komen runs, the larger organizations that can leverage benefits back, it really gives us some guidance as to where you should be focusing your efforts and says that corporations from a cost marketing standpoint are really looking for that return on investment. And a statistic of note is that in terms of the share of corporate grants, healthcare organizations in Kansas City receive 6% of corporate foundation funding. Again, compared to 13% nationally. So we're lagging at about 40 to 50%. One thing that we thought would be very instructive for you is to look at the impact of healthcare in our economy and the impact of the healthcare sector within the nonprofit community. And so I want to invite Lori Larson up here to review some of that data that she has gleaned from independent research, as well as information from Donor Edge at the Community Foundation. Thanks.
Thank you, Jennifer, and good morning. The next few slides that we're going to take a look at are a little bit different lens. Jennifer has been talking about charitable giving in Kansas City, focusing on healthcare. And what we're going to transition to is looking at more of the economic impact of the healthcare, and we're going to broaden our scope in revenue. Giving in Kansas City focuses on charitable contributions. And what we're going to talk about now is we're going to open it up and also include revenue that comes from program revenue or earned income, and also looking at government grants. The slide that you see here demonstrates the economic impact of healthcare as far as the nonprofit sector overall in Kansas City. And this is based on data from the Midwest Center for Nonprofit Leadership. We've got about 3,257 organizations that are filing 990s, and they are generating $10.78 billion overall in the nonprofit sector. And you can see there in the middle of this slide, the healthcare sector is represented, and it clearly dominates a 45% of the economy that is being generated in the nonprofit sector. Another thing that's very significant about the healthcare sector is it's generating a tremendous amount of economic impact, but it's also operating very efficiently. As you'll note, the light blue column is the number of organizations that are generating that revenue. So you've got high economic impact and revenue and a very efficient set of organizations that are achieving that. Now, you'll see also that comparing some of the slides that you just saw with Jennifer and Giving USA, we talked about healthcare being 5% of the Kansas City giving, and this one shows it's 45%. The difference between these numbers, again, is we are now including earned revenue and government grants, which are significantly impacting healthcare sectors. We want to talk a little bit about the workforce. If we just look at private employment in Kansas City and then what that consists of, it excludes military, government, and business proprietorships, we're going to see a very similar thread as we look through these slides and how efficient the healthcare sector aggregately is generating its revenue. You can see that the healthcare and the social assistance labor force is the smallest of the three, but again, it's generating the most significant impact in the economic sector. Now, we're going to start drilling down just a little bit more as far as the healthcare sector in Kansas City. This is a pie chart that shows the four major areas of healthcare. And again, we're still thinking about the Midwest Center data set. So we've got 317 orgs filing 990s, and they're generating 4.77 million in revenue annually. And you can see from this slide that the health or general rehabilitation organizations are by far generating the primary sources of revenue. The organizations that are in that sector are the big hospitals. We've got Truman, we've got Children's Mercy, we've got St. Luke's, we've got University of Kansas Research Center, and those types of organizations. If you are interested, as we go through this, if you're interested in getting a list of which organizations are in which categories, if you'll just follow up with me or email me at the end of the meeting, I'll be glad to provide that information. We're going to drill down just a little bit further and take a look at each of the subsectors. And this is a slide that shows you the 10 highest revenue subsectors in healthcare. You'll see once again, hospitals are leading the way, and look again at the difference in the bars. The navy blue or the darker blue is the amount of revenue that these organizations are generating, and then the lighter blue is the number of organizations that are generating this revenue. So we have a couple of things that are very interesting about this slide. Number one, the 10 largest revenue subsectors are generating 88% of the healthcare sector in Kansas City, but they're represented by only 33%. So again, you have big dollars, small amount of organizations that are generating that revenue. A couple of the unique subsectors here, again, are the hospitals, the general and specialty, and the outpatient, with low number of organizations generating a high amount of revenue. And then we also have the opposite. You'll see some of those bars are flipped. So we've got large number of organizations that are actually generating less revenue. And so this poses the question, is there opportunity here for shared resources, collaborations? There are many options that organizations can explore beyond going the full distance of thinking about mergers and acquisitions. So if these organizations are having sustainability problems, it's a great opportunity to start those conversations. This chart shows the diversity of annual budget size in all of the healthcare sectors. So again, we're still looking at the same organizations focusing on healthcare, and this is data that's been provided by GuideStar. And what's interesting about this pie chart is that even though this contains all of the healthcare organizations all the way from the largest to the smallest, we don't have any dominant budget sizes in any of these. It's very diverse. There's no more than about a 13% swing of organizations that are in here. So it's very diverse. Still in the same landscape that we just talked about from the data set from GuideStar, this is the total revenue to total expense ratios. It basically tells us what percent of organizations are operating in the black versus those that are struggling or clearly operating in the red. And so we've got about 60% of healthcare organizations that are operating positively, about 18% that are kind of borderline, they're just a little bit under breaking even, and then we've got 23% that are definitely running in a deficit. So this poses the question. Those that are running with a deficit or clearly under a deficit, how are they sustaining their operations? Are they pulling from endowments? What's the capability and the usage regulations around the endowments? How are temporary and restricted assets playing into this? Or are they just relying on surplus from previous years? So those questions are really important as we help to move the sector forward. Now we're going to move a little bit into a really deeper dive into the healthcare sector. And this information is based on the Community Foundation's nonprofit search, which is formerly known as Donor Edge. And Donor Edge provides very comprehensive information on organizations, but we don't go quite as wide as geographic scope of the GuideStar and the Midwest Center does on their data. But this is a picture of looking at primary revenue sources for each of the organizations, and because of all the pass-through dollars in healthcare, instead of looking at revenue size and how those primary revenue sources fall out within the different sizes, we looked at full-time equivalents, full-time employee staff. And what we found was that the smaller the organization or the smaller the number of employees an organization has, the more they rely on charitable giving. So if you start at the left of the slide and work your way over to the right, the larger organizations with many more employees are very dependent on government and earned revenue. This actually is the same type of relationship that we see if we break it down by budget size versus full-time employees. But just to be on the safe side, because of pass-through dollars in the healthcare center, we chose to do the FTEs. what's interesting, I think, about this slide and something to take away is, as we're all being challenged as to how to keep that sustainability and how to at least maintain where we are as far as development dollars, if you can place yourself, take a look at your own primary revenue sources. And what we're looking at here, you'll see in the legend, it's the special events, earned revenue, individual giving, government, and foundation and corporations. Does your organization also fall within these same general guidelines? And are these the right general guidelines for your organization? If you are a larger organization and you don't have much in individual contributions, we've already seen through the Giving in Kansas City report that Jennifer just presented, there's a huge opportunity here for more individual giving. Same thing on the flip side for the smaller organizations. Is there any opportunity for you to be able to provide some program services where you can generate some earned income? And this last slide builds even a little bit more on what we just looked at the previous slide. And some of the fields in the nonprofit profile look at top funding sources. And these are different than 990 categories. We're really looking to see which funders in an anonymous way are supporting the different organizations. We do not find any dominant funders or sources really in any of these, but what we do find is a correlation of the previous slide we just saw. The larger employers are relying a great deal on government grants and earned revenue. The medium-sized employers, we start to see more private and family foundations, trusts coming into the picture. And then the smaller organizations with a smaller staff is definitely all about individual and charitable giving. And so with that, I would like to go ahead and bring up Mary Ellen, and she's going to discuss the results of the nonprofit survey that you all prepared.
Thank you, Lori. Good morning, everyone. We've been seeing so far this morning statistics about overall Kansas City giving. And what we're going to talk about now is the information that hopefully many of you in this room provided for us through the surveys that were completed online. The information that we have provided in the handout is a compilation of a lot of information that you provided us, and importantly, anecdotal notes that you provided as well. When we look at what has happened when we look at overall the information that is provided, we know that demographically, as Lori said earlier, there's a tremendous amount of diversity among budgets and what each of you have to work with each year. I know that in visiting with you on a one-to-one basis, we find that this has been particularly key during the past 6 months because budgets have been cut. Some budgets have been expanded by, as we've learned, not filling positions. And so those are some of the strategies that we've used to try to accommodate the fundraising challenges that we've had during the past few months. When we look at the information that you provided, however, we know that the majority of you have seen a decrease of up to about 24% of the fundraising that's occurred. We know that with regards to endowments, there's been a significant change, however, and about 70% of you reported that you saw a change in your endowment of anywhere from 25 to 40% decrease in your endowment investment income. So we'd like to hear from you later on if this is what you're seeing in your organization as well. Just a little information about the group that's here this morning. There's about 40% of our hospitals or hospital systems are represented. So we are making a bit of an assumption by saying that might be also who filled out this survey. We've got managed care here. We've also got a significant number of disease-related organizations represented here and some national organizations as well. So we see we have a significant cross-section of what this information of the background in the organizations that has come to us. Surprisingly, 18% of the people that completed the survey reported that they have had more donors, and we are certainly thrilled to hear that good news and to be able to share that good news with you. Surprising maybe that it might be even higher is that only 53% said that they have had less donors since January of 2009. In terms of those individuals that reported a significant large loss, we know that matches up with the reporting for the foundations. And so we have to assume that might be reporting a loss of a foundation fund or a significant supporter. But only 60% said that there's no increase from past supporters. And in terms of looking at how we've handled this, we know that online giving was reported frequently in the notes, that people have turned to online giving to help support or bolster their fundraising. A lot of you reported that you have improved your website, hoping that would also stimulate online giving, and that would certainly be consistent with how we're trying to tighten up or manage our budgets better, because we have some additional information I'll share with you in a moment about how we took a look at the way that we move forward with direct marketing. This slide, however, looks at restricted and unrestricted giving and what you are seeing in your organizations. About 62% of you reported an increase in unrestricted giving. And so that's very encouraging. We have to assume that's because organizations have turned back to basic fundraising strategies. And we know in talking with our executive directors, a lot of them have said that they've reinstituted more personal touches with their donors or with their prospects. And they've had the opportunity or the time to work on getting back to the fundamentals of fundraising, so that might be why we're seeing an increase in unrestricted giving from individuals. When we look then at foundation giving and fundraising from foundations, about 40% of you reported that you did not see a change in 2009 in foundation giving. About 22% said that it was increased, and about 30% said that it was decreased. A lot of organizations have reported that they have actually increased the number of foundation applications that they've completed, attempting to turn to the foundations for more support. Other organizations' strategies have been, they feel in the past, relying on foundations too much. And so they've taken a look at what are the basics that we're doing, and if we are heavy on our revenues from foundations, then we need to make certain that we can withstand another storm like this from a decrease in the economy, and then be able to know that our contacts with our individuals are strong enough to help us through that. Other fundraising programs and how you responded to our survey that you have handled or what the responses have been since 2009. We know that with regards to events, corporations have increased by about 22%. We found it very encouraging that more than half of you, or actually 60%, said that you didn't see a change in attendance at events. And about 30% said that the net income was actually increased. Unfortunately, about the same amount said that the net income from an event was decreased, however. And as we saw from the earlier slide, the foundation income for revenues was decreased by about 70% of you, as much as 39%. So when we look at what are we going to do and what are you doing, these are some of the things we want to hear from you later on this morning. What additional strategies have you put into place, and what do you plan for the next 12 months to put into place to be able to counteract some of these changes? Organizationally, we've provided a lot of information here, so let me pull this down to some of the more significant pieces. We hear repeatedly that organizations have not filled empty positions. I know a couple of us were visiting earlier this morning, and that is pretty significant across the board as a measure to not have to lay anyone off. 26% have unfortunately had staff layoffs, and in visiting with you out in the community, we know that those are principally the larger organizations that have laid off staff people rather than the smaller organizations that are so tightly staffed anyway. 43% of you have reduced program budgets. And we know that one of the areas that, from the comments that you've made, that you've done a significant decrease is in direct mail. It's also in events. Expenses for events have been shored up, not putting in quite as many frills as we formerly put into an event in order to keep our expenses down. And hopefully, as we saw in the slide earlier, our income has stayed the same or in certain cases has gone up. So going to an electronic format seems to be something that everyone has relied on as a strategy to improve fundraising during these difficult times. Planning activities have significantly increased by comments that have been made, only 17% by the survey results from you. But we know that in visiting with you, everyone is planning a little more carefully with regards to what they're going to what their next move might be. I know also in visiting with you, with regards to those organizations that have completed a campaign, one strategy has been that more quickly or sooner than you historically have, you've gone back to those funders. Their campaign pledge may be completed, and that's been your approach to look at those funders. Other strategies that we've seen have been individuals are taking more time to plan their campaign. But campaigns are still in the works. They're still moving forward. And we know that one of the challenges with regards to the things that make healthcare unique, certainly in a hospital, I know from visiting with a CEO recently, his comment was, well, we certainly are not going to push forward as quickly with our physician campaign, because we know that healthcare reform has put a lot of physicians a bit on edge, might be a nice way of putting that. They're fearful about what their revenues may be, and so until that time occurs, that seems to be, in talking with hospitals, the primary program that they've put on hold or are not moving forward as quickly in the timeline if they are in a campaign. So additional strategies are that a lot of organizations are really relying more on getting back to their mission, getting back to fundraising basics. They're using their missions more as a springboard for their fundraising. So we're looking forward to hearing from you. I'd like to introduce now to you Judy Keller, if I can move this. Oh, sorry. Well, let's see. I might need some technical support here.
I know that I'm the right one to do it. Let's just do an escape, and off you go.
All right. We put together a couple questions, and I'd like to introduce Judy Keller, who's going to lead our discussion for the remainder of the morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary Ellen. And actually, we're going to ask you to help us out and record some of the notes. This is the pop quiz portion of the morning in which we want to fully engage you in discussion of the data that we've just presented and what it means specifically for your organization. So we'll take some time to open it up for questions, observations, discussion, and Mary Ellen will record for us, and those notes will be available on the internet, as is this presentation. I know, without putting her on the spot, I believe Betsy Topper is here from the REACH Foundation. Betsy. Alice is here. Good, good. Well, a couple of times we made specific reference to the foundation funding of Kansas City's healthcare community and just how critical it is. And again, without putting you on the spot, I'm going to put you on the spot. If you have general observations that you would like to make, we'd certainly welcome them.
Sure. Okay, she's not going to put me on the spot, but then
but here
Michelle
she is.
Handed me a microphone.
Now, in fairness, this was a setup question.
I actually do have a couple of just sort of reactions from the foundation perspective to this data, and I'm not speaking for every foundation. This is just the REACH Foundation. Our assets dropped by 30%. I mean, the bottom really fell out, and for a number of months, we were below historic dollar value. As we talk to other foundations, we know that a lot of other foundations experienced the same decrease in their asset base. So I think there's an interesting synchronicity between our asset drop and your experience of what was happening in your fundraising, obviously. We are just beginning to creep back up, and we're a hair over our historic dollar value now. We're in the middle of budget planning for 2010, and one of the issues that our board is going to be struggling with is how do we balance the need to sort of right-size our asset base so that we're continuing to make grants from our interest income versus getting dollars into the community to organizations who are seeing greater numbers of people who need your services because people are losing jobs and losing insurance and all of that sort of stuff. So it's going to be an interesting fall for us. So that's our reality bumping into your reality. We've noticed really since we began making grants, and we're a baby foundation. We didn't start until 2005. But it's very clear that the organizations that come to us for money, we ask their revenue sources by category, and many of them, a huge proportion of them, report 1% or less than 1% from individual donors or individual gifts, and the lion's share of their funding is entirely foundation reliant. The lesson, I think, of 2008 is that's a really bad position to be in, because when our assets drop, our ability to give you money drops as well. I think the other thing, just because this is all healthcare meeting, we've heard from a number of our applicants and grantees that when the two healthcare foundations were established, that other foundations who historically have given dollars to healthcare decided not to do that anymore figuring that that was covered by the REACH Foundation and the Healthcare Foundation. And so I would be interested, and I bet Alice would be interested as well, in hearing your perspective on that. So if you're reliant on foundations, period, that's not a good thing. If you're reliant on two foundations because nobody else is funding in healthcare, that's a really bad thing.
Thank you, Betsy, and thank you for allowing us to put you on the spot. Alice, do you have any other comments that you'd like to add from the funder's perspective?
Well, I will add that we are Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas City. We're not a foundation. We do corporate charitable contributions. We do it on an annual basis, an annual budget. And what we have seen this year and the end of last year, strangely enough, we have not yet been negatively impacted by the economy crisis. We find in the health insurance industry that during these times of watching monies go in and out, folks are taking less elective surgeries. They are going to the doctors less. They're not doing those things they would normally do related to what our revenue is related to, our providers' payments and all. However, we know that once this ends, which is likely to be the end of this year or sometime next year, we'll see our claims go up. We'll see more payout from our revenues because people will get back into their regular doctor's payments and co-payments and elective surgeries and visits and all. So we think that will impact our industry to in sometime next year. We have an annual budget that we present to our board of directors on a calendar year. We'll do that in December. And we are very heavy into small contributions to those organizations that are related to health and wellness within the general community. Many of the organizations represented today. We are also looking at our mission of community wellness and looking at partnerships, preventive medicine, our preventive health care, preventive wellness type things, disease management, and really are looking heavily into what we can do in the future to see what partnerships are out there with among the health and wellness community and those folks who support that or work in that industry, and how we could look at some of the preventive measures. And that's going to be really, really high priority for our corporation.
Great. Thank you. And I'm sorry I didn't introduce you properly. Alice Allison from Blue Cross Blue Shield, longtime supporter in the nonprofit sector. All right, what are the rest of you seeing? What are your takeaways from the data that's been presented? There are a couple things that certainly leap to our minds, but let's see how you've interpreted this data. Would anyone like to take a jump in? What's the number one piece of information you're taking home? Implications? Everybody awake? Good morning. Let's have a hearty good morning. All right, thank you. Well, one of the initial reflections that I certainly see from the data is the potential that exists in individual giving. And I think we all know it intuitively, but let's go back to our existing operations and take a look at what can be done to diversify revenue. First of all, if we don't have enough revenue coming from individuals, and as Betsy has reminded us, it's going to be tough for foundations. Their endowments are down just as ours are as nonprofit organizations. We have got to diversify our revenue and not depend specifically on foundation funding. That's certainly one of the things that that I heard her say. Are you finding the same thing true in your organizations? Do you feel a need to focus back on individuals? No? Please stand up and introduce yourself, if you don't mind.
Yeah, my name is Gene Reedforce at Truman, and thank you. We've noted that in terms of giving, our percentages almost flip-flop what they ought to be. As you said, about 79% of our money comes from foundations and some corporations, less than 20% from individuals, and so we're now aggressively looking at ways to increase individual giving by going out more into the community because, as was said earlier, those organizations that rely on foundations and even on major donors as opposed to a large base of donors are in big trouble. And so we recognize that and are doing what we can and will be doing what we can to reach out into the community more, not only for funds but also for more visibility.
And beefing up a major gifts program in particular?
Well, as a result of that, we would hope that it would flow into major gifts, but you have to start in the community by getting donors, period, before you can get major donors.
Sure.
People tend not to start at the highest levels.
So you're considering acquisition as a real priority?
Uh-huh.
Great. Yeah, if you remember those earlier slides, we saw that the disparity between what's being given in healthcare nationally at 75%, 70% in Kansas City, that shows a gap and an opportunity in terms of individual giving. Anyone else? We've heard from a hospital foundation.
Sandy Shaw, Spelman Medical Foundation. One of the things that we see is that our donors are asking us a great deal about how much of our funds go to indigent care. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a reasonable question. But I'd be interested in other people having that as a change in the conversation with donors.
Mm-hmm. Is anyone finding that the conversation with donors, individual donors, changes? That it's changed, not only in terms of their own giving and their own financial planning, but in the questions they're asking? I think you raise a very, very valid point. Has anyone else seen a change in how that conversation plays out with prospective donors? No? I've certainly worked with clients that want to know what the administrative, whose donors want to know what the administrative expense is. 5 years ago, they weren't asking about that. Anyone else? No? Okay. One of the other takeaways in my mind was from the earlier slide of the survey that said only 50% of us have endowments. Now, what's that about? Smaller organizations that are struggling to maintain their operating budget and not yet moved into endowments? Does anyone have any light to shed on why we'd only have 50% with endowments? Well, we've got a quiet group. We're going to have to ask some easier questions, aren't we? How many of you are from hospitals? Just a minute, Janet, I'll get to you. Okay. And how many of you are from voluntary health organizations or not hospitals? About half and half. And it's really a different conversation, isn't it? The hospitals generally have foundations, have endowments, are up and running and tweaking programs that have been up and running for many years. And for the smaller nonprofit organizations, many times it's just year to year. Can we make the budget? One of the other slides we saw that I thought was very important was that 40% of our survey respondents are in some sort of financial trouble, either just making budget or facing a deficit and funding their operations in other ways. And we need to look at what that means for them and how they can help themselves. Janet?
You've really addressed what I was going to say. You were kind of answering the question about why endowments or why not. For smaller organizations, endowments are not often well-funded and have suffered some of the same investment losses that foundations have, so have to regain their corpus before they can be tapped into, and they're not a focus or an emphasis for giving requests right now.
Mm-hmm. And yet, we know that, at least from the literature, there are some very simple things we can do to start plan giving programs, for example, which is the easiest, say, to solicit bequest income. Some of the easiest and most effective plan gifts are simple bequests, and small nonprofit organizations have that opportunity. That doesn't always take full-time staff. But I think you're absolutely right. When it's hand-to-mouth, it's hard to, you know, you've got to feed your kids before you can send them off to college. It's the same sort of thing. Some of us are just working for our annual operating budget.
Okay. Hi, my name is Sue. Son? Okay. My name is Sue Speck. I'm from North Care Hospice. I think one of the challenges, which is heavily funded by Medicare, Medicaid systems, which is some of the questions we're going to have to address, is the health care reform, what effect it's going to have on that, and how we provide the difference between what we will be getting, or we're sort of hospital-based because we're owned by North Kansas City Hospital. But the health care reforms, and I went out and did speaking on Sunday, and that was one of the major questions was, will your hospice still be funded under the health care reform? And how do we advocate for it?
You need a microphone.
An organization that their CEO is on the board of the Missouri Hospital Association and extremely well informed about healthcare reform and its effect on what is a standalone hospital. And this CEO said that he feels that philanthropy is going to be needed even more. Because when you look at the number of individuals, and Alice referred to it earlier by saying that the numbers of claims are down, that's because people are not seeking care. They're trying to feed their children. And so if healthcare reform does, as it's promising, going take care of more individuals, hospitals are going to be flooded. There's a group of strategists who feel that we're going to go back to wards. That's a little severe. But the viewpoint is that we're going to have more patients coming into the hospital because they can finally get care because it's being provided for them. So as a result, the perspective from this CEO was that philanthropy is going to be needed more than ever to help support the changes that healthcare reform are going to bring. I'd love to hear what your perspectives are.
We are seeing an increased interest in either launching foundations or launching endowments as a way to generate interest in philanthropy. I think Mary Ellen presented a great example of that. Anyone else on the issue of endowment? No?
One of the observations I have, I'm David Folk at Truman Medical Center Charitable Foundation, and one of the observations I have regarding the need for philanthropy within the context of health reform is that while we're going to try to do more to get patients' care met and the salaries of individuals providing that care met, it seems to me that perhaps the greater need for philanthropy is going to, and endowments, is going to have to come in helping healthcare make the advancements that it will have to have in these incredible expenditures of equipment. And what we'll be seeing down the road is more modernization to make sure that healthcare is not just, we're not just doing Band-Aids, that we're doing these kinds of incredible things that healthcare can do and will be doing more of down the road. So maybe that's the way philanthropy and endowments will play a more crucial role.
Unless we get too pessimistic about what healthcare is going to, what healthcare reform is going to mean for individuals, remember that with the aging population and a very committed constituency in a traditional grateful patient, there are going to be a lot of opportunities for reaching out to individuals. One of the issues, not only healthcare reform, but stimulus funding, I think, are the two issues that maybe we've not addressed that are certainly in the headlines. And I'd like to call on my colleague, if I may, Jennifer. You have done some research specifically on healthcare reform and stimulus funding and what it means specifically for our sector. So if we could ask Jennifer to give us a bit of an update, that'd be great.
I just wanted to actually highlight the healthcare reform as an issue. Melissa Brown, who's the chief researcher for Giving USA, will be coming actually via WebEx to the Funders Forum next week. And in preparation for that conversation, we spoke with her about what she calls reading the tea leaves. And certainly, healthcare reform is one of what she would call the seven major stressors that she is anticipating are going to challenge us as a nonprofit community and also the foundation community, others being the twin pulls of endowments being down, particularly in higher education, combined with the increasing need for more scholarship money with young people entering higher education, certainly just the general dynamic of foundation dollars coming being in decreased availability. But as it relates to stimulus money, not so much from a national perspective, but here in the bi-state area, I would really like to hear back from you all what challenges that's presented, what opportunities you've seen, or whether you've just given up on it because of the political dynamics. I know that Governor Nixon announced $156 million in stimulus money coming through in late August. Some of the safety net healthcare centers have been able to take advantage of that. Not a whole lot in the Kansas City area as far as what we could see. I'm seeing some heads nod. When we've been talking with other organizations, particularly in health and human services, that's an area that we inquire about with respect to infrastructure and capital improvements. And the general tone seems to be a little bit of frustration and lack of information on how to move forward. So I really would like more feedback from this group. Is this an opportunity? Is it a challenge? Is it a non-issue for you? And maybe that speaks more to the Planned Parenthoods and the safety net organizations that are here than the hospitals. But I also know there's some health technology funding that is available for the major health care providers as well.
Thanks. So. Marquita Taylor, Swope Health Services. I will say that we were fortunate to receive some of the stimulus money. Well, we've got a long way to go. We have several different initiatives still out, waiting to see what, you know, what those opportunities are. But do know that it's the money's national, so we're still going to see how we play or what our part will be in that. But I guess we are looking at it, it's been a long time coming, so we're not trying to rely so much on that opportunity, knowing that the money goes across the entire United States. So we are taking a closer look into other opportunities. We're looking more into going to look at individual giving, which is something we haven't done as been very successful in, and leaning, trying to wait on the stimulus but not depend on it.
The HIT stimulus money has some undefined areas that have made it difficult for us to tap into some of that. Some of the money is defined as going to support individual providers who have high percents of Medicaid patients. And if a provider doesn't hit that area but has a Medicaid population or is part of the a public or private health clinic, that's a gray area. That's undefined. Mm-hmm. So we're working nationally to try to seek some clarity in some of that before we are able to tap into some of those resources.
That money's moved pretty quickly, and I know some of the rules are being written as we speak, and in an effort to get the money on the streets as quickly as possible. It wasn't always clear, unlike the appropriation process where things are pretty much set in stone from one year to the next. Yeah, great. We had another comment?
From the point of view from the stimulus package, what I've observed, I'm with Planned Parenthood, and what I've observed, unless you're a state or county health department, hospital, or a federally qualified health center, other organizations really aren't having access to this money.
I just want to make a reflection on that as it relates to fundraising and some of the data that we presented. You know, I talked about the high number or the high percentage of foundation and corporate giving in Kansas City in the healthcare sector compared to household giving. And if we were looking back at GivingUSA and some of the studies that the Center on Philanthropy has done, Patrick Rooney did an independent study that talked about the inverse relationship between the reliance on government funds and private philanthropy. Well, I think we've got some of that dynamic going on here, the inverse relationship. The more that we're talking about looking at government grants, and I guess I would caution us not to see that as the panacea. Sounds like you're looking at it from a healthy perspective with respect to stimulus funds. The dollars, there are dollars out there, and it's incumbent upon us to explore those opportunities but not become reliant. If there's that big message here is we really got to focus on the individuals, and that's where it's at. I'm seeing a lot of heads nod, so that's good affirmation.
I would just follow up with what Jennifer says, Jeffrey Byrne, that the young lady from Planned Parenthood about seeking dollars from our federal, state, and local governments. We elect our congressmen, our senators, our city council members, our state reps, and our governor to, I believe, support the organizations that make our communities healthy and better. And if you're not at the line in your state rep's office or in the governor's office or in the state health department or the city health department or your congressional or Senate staffs, it's the staffs that really do make possibilities for grant opportunities, whether those be earmarks, and there are earmarks. We are receiving for our clients earmarks from Senate and congressmen or competitive grant opportunities. And I think that's what you were referring to in the area of stimulus funding, is that this has been narrowed down to certain providers. But there are, in the Federal Registry, opportunities for all of our organizations to think about and partner in our own communities to bring those dollars back to us. So I encourage all of us to, you know, we hire our elected officials, and we should make them responsive and responsible back to our community needs.
Is anyone in the room a registered lobbyist or been one in the past? Now, it's not an AA meeting for registered lobbyists, but I do want to tell you there's so much similarity, and argue with me if you'd like to. I mean, if you disagree, but I think there's so much similarity in the advocacy process in trying to move a piece of legislation related to healthcare at the state level or at the national level, and trying to move a grant request through the decision-making process. You've got to advocate for your issue or your effort or your program, and it's very, very similar. And for the small organizations that really are perhaps even too small to have a full-time lobbyist, there are great opportunities in collaborating with perhaps a larger organization that has that capability. And we are seeing and hearing a lot of questions about collaboration and public-private partnerships that, again, perhaps 5 years ago weren't on the table. So a couple of messages, I'd say, or observations, and I don't see anyone disagreeing. think about the advocacy and lobbying branches in your own organization and what you might be able to do with them to leverage financial support for your organization.
Yeah, Judy, let me just ask the crowd a question. I'm John Marshall with Jeffrey Byrne Associates. I'm very curious about the response that you all have received from your boards. We know that board participation in fundraising can many times be the absolute key to success. So I'm curious as to what you're hearing from your boards, and conversely, what are you asking of your boards, if not more now than a year ago, 2 years ago? How is that going, and what kind of response are you getting?
Anyone? This is an opportunity to talk about your board members. They're not here. It's okay. And don't identify yourself.
I'm Amy Peters. I'm from Planned Parenthood. I'm the recently hired director of development, and I come from the education world. And I think that it's probably true for most organizations that you need board buy-in, and the board needs to understand how important fundraising is. Something that we're working on is with our board, when we're looking at board members, setting out those expectations initially, whether that's an expectation of a gift or referrals or whatever the case may be. And so in recent history, we haven't really had a functional development committee, and I have been working with our board on that, and I think they really see the importance of it. A lot of them will say, oh, we're not fundraisers, so maybe instead they'll open up their pocketbook because they'd rather write out their own check versus having to ask five of their friends for money. You know, if they're uncomfortable doing that, I'll say, can you at least give me those names and make a warm introduction? So I think that, you know, from our perspective, we're really feeling that fundraising needs to start with our board. You know, these are people who are choosing to be involved with the organization, and we're setting expectations for them.
Mm-hmm. How many of your boards are at 100% giving, annual giving? Show of hands. Ooh, there's an opportunity. We need 100% annual giving from our boards. And most of us know that, but what are we doing to work on that? What's the plan? Okay. So next year we'll do this and everyone will say we're at 100% or we're at 80%. Any other observations specifically about what you are seeing since the market adjustment almost a year ago? Well, just a year ago. And then more importantly, let's transition to, because I always like to think the glass is half full, even if it's only a third full or quarter full. What's your plan? What are we doing differently? We've heard an emphasis on acquisition from an established foundation. We've heard a couple of folks talking about looking for stimulus funding but not relying on it. And I believe there's consensus around focusing on individual giving. Are those fair takeaways? Three fair takeaways? Okay. Amy?
Well, something we're really focusing on, and a lot of people have talked about it, is really being in front of individual donors. I think sometimes it's easy to get nervous about calling individual donors when the economy is bad because they know why we're calling. You know, but people will still meet with you, and maybe they can't give now what they'd like to give. But a lot of times they're willing to give what they can. And I've also find it is a great environment for planned giving. You know, we kind of talked about it a little bit. But, you know, if people supported you for a long time, they're not all of a sudden going to change their passion about your mission. So we're very mission-driven in the statements we're making to our donors. And we're saying, okay, if you can't give it now, what about including us in your estate plan? Like you said, a bequest is so easy. You know, every piece of literature we send out, every ask we make, we ask if people have included us in their estate plan or would like more information. So I think the desire is still there, and I think you're right on point where it's just being in front of people as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. And I would challenge our organizations that in creating our fundraising budgets, if we know
roughly 85% of our funding comes from individuals. How does our expense budget line up? Are we expending 85% of our resources in major gifts? No, rarely is that the case. But you're right. It's absolutely an opportunity for planned giving and for beginning that conversation. We're glad you want to help us. We're glad you understand the program. If not today, we understand. How about tomorrow? Sure.
I'd be curious to know, Jean, a little bit more about your acquisition, your thoughts about acquisition. How are you approaching that? I mean, is it direct mail? Is it something, you know, why hadn't you done that in the past? Why is it a new strategy for you? How much are you involving email? How much is, you know, social media part of that? So if you could share with us a little bit about that.
Well, as I said, we've just begun, and I can't say how much of the past was devoted to acquisition because I haven't been there very long, since I'm just a youngster. we'll rely on direct mail, of course, and I don't believe Truman has ever mailed to its grateful patients based on an assumption that our grateful patients are not gratefully wealthy. And I think that's a false notion, that everyone at least deserves an opportunity to participate and to give back, even if they're not able to give back in large numbers. And so that's one area that would be acquisition, although technically it may not be acquisition because they have an affinity with Truman as opposed to someone on a list that might be rented. But we'll be doing direct mail. We're not doing very much in email right now, but that's an area that we hope to expand and extend more than we're doing. And also using more of the folks on our staff who have face-to-face direct contact with donors to emphasize to them the need for individual giving and to enlist their support in finding others and finding other ways to reach out. So, as I say, we're just beginning.
Sounds like you're really taking a look at the basic fundraising pyramid and getting back to basics in many ways. All right.
Hi, I'm Kate Mignaron. I work at University of Kansas Hospital, and I was just going to add on to what Jean said at Truman, and we're focused on acquisition as well and the individual donors. That's something that we've been looking at and trying to be creative about the grateful patient. And again, what you mentioned is kind of going back to that core, those concentric circles that we all learn about in Fundraising 101. And those are the people that that really know our service already and, you know, already have that affinity. And how can we get in front of them? How can we talk to them? Is it direct mail? What's the best way? So we're really looking at those kind of projects as well. What can meet the needs of and touch those grateful patients to make them understand how they can give and what impact they can make?
Mm-hmm. And that is a perfect segue to sort of wrapping this up with a reminder of what our best practices are. Here's what we would suggest. Right now, we want to be strategic. This is not a time to back off. And I think those of you that have to ask or advocate for your operating budgets internally need to really focus on this. It is not a time to back off fundraising by any means. You want to be transparent with your donors. You want to communicate with them and be very honest with them, as they will with you. They'll be honest about their financial situation today, and you can be honest with them about your cost effectiveness in fundraising, about your programming, about reminding them that it's really not about the money. It's about the good service and programs that their money makes possible. We want you to be understanding, too. We want you to acknowledge donor concerns. Don't brush off. I mean, you'd almost look foolish to not acknowledge that that the economy has changed and the financial climate is different than it was a year ago. That's all right. Acknowledge it. We need to be patient with our donors. Many of them in conversations will say, yes, I do still care about you, but I can't right now, and that's okay. We're there for the long haul. We want you to be flexible, not only in problem solving and allowing options. We are seeing, for example, multi-year pledges where single pledges used to be the case, perhaps pledges paid not the same amount over a three-year period, but a graduated or a balloon payment, if you will. Get flexible. In-kind donations, if they really do. Of course, cash is king, but there are many times that an in-kind donation can make all the difference, especially in a capital project. We want you to be proactive, to take a look at your acquisition program, and a lot of that's already been discussed. Many people in the room talked about targeting our specific constituencies. Remember back at the slide, many slides ago, about FTEs within the healthcare sector? We've got a lot of people employed in healthcare in this community, and they are very close to our organization. They are one of those inner circles. So let's not overlook the staff campaign, the board campaign, the grateful patients. Take a look at the people and the organizations that are already involved in healthcare in this community. Since it is 45% of the nonprofit economy in this community, there are a lot of people involved in healthcare already. So let's be proactive about targeting specific constituencies. Someone already used the word creative, and we love to hear that. You've got to keep things fresh. Be bold. We want you to launch to the next level of fundraising. If you don't have an endowment, think about it. If you don't have a memorial program, an honorary gift program, if you're thinking about a capital campaign and you're thinking not now, not now, not now, well, let me remind you that it takes a good 3 to 9 months to plan a capital campaign. So you need to be thinking about it now for when things do turn around. And finally, you've got to be compelling. It's got to be a program worth giving money to. And hospitals are very good at coming up with specific appeals for specific purposes. And I would challenge everyone in the room to take a look at what's most core in the programs and services they provide and package that in a fundraising way that is very, very compelling. Well, it's 9:30 on the dot, and we want to thank you all for coming, for participating in this first of many sectors. And I think Michelle has some closing comments. Thank you.
Yes, thank you all so much. Couple of things. I was thinking about the Be Creative slide. I know that, you know, it's kind of an interesting time that we're all living in right now, but I know St. Luke's has initiated a new fundraising event at the Plaza Art Fair this year, and I've heard that it's close to sold out, so that's great news to hear for you guys. So I say share those stories to encourage you and invite you to continue to encourage each other with those stories. The other thing I wanted, and I'm kind of alluded to it when we were talking about acquisition, is the whole notion of social marketing and ways to do outreach. This fall at the Philanthropy Midwest Conference, we have someone named Scott Goodstein, who was on Obama's campaign, coming to talk about grassroots marketing and fundraising. So that's a great way to learn more about how to accomplish that work. There's several sessions on social networking from an executive director level about strategy down to more of a fundraising person actually implementing it. So I really encourage you as you look over those conference materials to think about that. And then the last thing I would add is that Robert Egger is going to be here as the keynote on the second day, so Thursday, November 19th. And his focus is about, he's got a new campaign called the V3 campaign, the voice, value, and vote of the nonprofit sector, and really sharing insights about how nonprofits really need to advocate for themselves and how they can do that work. So lots of great things will be at the conference this fall that really tie into some of the groundwork we laid today. So again, I appreciate all of you coming out today, sharing information through the survey by completing those, and then being here today to share. And then, you know, as we continue in 2010, hope that you'll be back with us to really dive into some of these topics. We might just have a session where we talk about acquisition and what everyone's experiencing. So that's the kind of work we hope to do with you in 2010. If you have any questions, feel free to always give us a call or shoot us an email. And have a good day.